Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the Healthcare Foundation of California, brought to you from the historic St. Francis Hotel on Union Square in San Francisco. Today's program is the second in a series of healthcare programs co-sponsored by our two organizations and focusing on important healthcare topics during this election year. I am Watson Letch, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and Program Committee, and your chairman today. We welcome the listeners of New York Public Radio joining us for this nationwide radio broadcast of America's longest-running radio program. We invite all of our listeners here and on radio to visit the Commonwealth Club's website at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now, here to introduce our speaker is Dr. Mark Smith, President and CEO of the Healthcare Foundation of California. Dr. Smith.
Thank you, Watson. I'm pleased to be here today for what promises to be a very interesting discussion of the issue of medical errors, which has been much in the news of late. The California Healthcare Foundation is pleased to be a partner in this health policy series with the Commonwealth Club of California. And let me briefly mention that the next three sessions of this series will be on July 11th, in which Karen Ignani of the Association of American Health Plans and Ron Pollock of Families USA will discuss healthcare reform in Oakland. August 3rd, Dr. Jane Henney, the Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, will be speaking in Silicon Valley. And on September 15th, Dr. David Satcher, the Surgeon General of the United States, will be speaking about public health and his role. The Foundation is committed to promoting a thoughtful discussion of health policy issues in California and the nation, and there's no organization better suited to provide a forum for this partnership than the Commonwealth Club of California. Joining us today is a distinguished speaker who's been instrumental in elevating the critical issue of medical errors in this country, Dr. Mark Chasson. He is professor and chairman of the Department of Health Policy at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. He's also senior vice president for clinical quality at the Mount Sinai NYU Medical Center and Health System. Prior to coming to Mount Sinai, Dr. Chasson served as commissioner of the New York State Department of Health, and as many of you know, had previously spent some 10 years in Southern California, where as a member of the faculty and a researcher, he helped pioneer the science of health quality measurement. He received his undergraduate and medical degrees from Harvard University and a master's degree in public policy from the Kennedy School of Government there. His MPH is from the University of California at Los Angeles. Dr. Chasson is a member of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences and co-chairs its National Roundtable on Healthcare Quality. The IOM's committee's report on the quality of healthcare in America, To Air Is Human, which highlighted the crisis in patient safety in the United States, resulting in 50 to 100,000 unnecessary deaths each year from preventable medical error, has, as you know, received widespread publicity. And we're pleased to have Dr. Chasson with us this afternoon to discuss medical mistakes, how safe is our healthcare system. Dr. Chasson.
Thank you, Mark. I am really delighted to be here. I'm deeply honored to stand at this august podium. Many great women and men have preceded me here, talking about some of the most widely debated issues in their fields. I'd like to speak with you this afternoon about a subject doctors don't usually like to talk about, and that is the mistakes that we make in healthcare. How frequent they are, how much harm they do, how big a problem is it after all, and what should we be doing about it. And let me start by just telling you a little bit about what we know about mistakes and the harm they cause. We make three different kinds of mistakes in healthcare, and they lead to three very different kinds of problems, and they are overuse, underuse, and misuse. Overuse is when we provide a service when its risk exceeds its benefit. So the patient can't benefit and harm results. Underuse is the reverse. It's the failure to provide an effective service when it would have produced a good outcome. And misuse occurs when we pick the right thing to do, but then we do it badly, and the patient gets an avoidable complication or is placed at risk of an avoidable complication. The Institute of Medicine report focused on this third category of mistakes, and appropriately so because it is perhaps one of the certainly leading causes of injury in the healthcare system, but it is by no means the only kind of mistake that leads to harm. This way of thinking about mistakes is very useful, it turns out, because each class of mistake requires different measurement to find it. It has different causes. It has different approaches to solution. And a lot of excellent research has gone into each of these different areas in mistakes, trying to figure out how big the problems are, how widespread they are, and how much harm they do. So what I'd like to do for a couple of minutes is to give you a very quick overview of about 30 years of research in this area to give you some highlights of these examples. And let's start with overuse. It's probably the least well appreciated of these areas of mistakes. One problem in this area is that 24 million Americans every year get antibiotics for colds and other viral respiratory infections from which they cannot possibly benefit. Antibiotics do not kill viruses, and so people taking antibiotics for colds cannot benefit from that experience. And yet, this does not happen rarely. In fact, the chance of an adult walking into a doctor's office with a cold and coming out with an antibiotic prescription, the odds are 50-50. 50% of the time that happens. In fact, if you add up all of that experience, fully one-fifth, 21% to be precise, of all antibiotics prescribed to patients outside of hospitals in the United States are wasted on colds and other viral infections, conditions they cannot possibly help. Clearly, this is an enormous economic waste, but it is also a tremendous quality problem. This one problem is the single most important preventable cause of the rising tide of resistance that we face in fighting new strains of bacteria and germs in our intensive care units every day. We fight these battles, and we too frequently lose. On a personal level, this factor is the single most important thing you can do as an individual avoiding these antibiotics to reduce your risk of becoming a carrier of resistant organisms waiting to infect a vulnerable individual. There are many other examples from the literature on overuse, from the simplest diagnostic tests that we do to the most complicated procedures. Another example is ear tubes, the tubes that get put in children's ears to prevent ear infections and to take fluid out. The most common surgical procedure in childhood, about 500,000 of these are done in the United States every year. And the single study that looked at this suggested that about a quarter of these were done for totally inappropriate reasons. Study after study documents this, and I think a fair review of that literature suggests that about 20% of what we do in healthcare can clearly be classified as overuse, of no benefit. If we got rid of it tomorrow, quality would go up because patients would be spared the risk that attends to these inappropriate services, and costs would go down at the same time. Clearly something we need to be worried about. That's overuse. Now, underuse, the second class of quality problems and of mistakes that we make, is actually equally harmful. In fact, the literature shows, the research on this subject shows, that every proven effective intervention that we know of, when it's been studied well, has been found to be underused, and not just by a few percentage points. The studies document over and over again, whether it's immunization, prenatal care, treatment for diabetes, or heart failure, breast cancer, or depression, time and time again, 30, 40, 50% of eligible patients who could benefit from these treatments do not receive them. Whether patients are enrolled in managed care or not managed care makes no difference. Underuse is ubiquitous. Let me give you one example to show you the magnitude of the harm that this problem does. We know from excellent research funded over the last decade and a half that four incredibly effective treatments for heart attacks save about 80 lives for every 1,000 patients we can treat. And I'm talking about things like thrombolytic drugs, clot-busting drugs, aspirin, beta blockers, all the effective treatments. We know from equally good research that we reach no more than about half of eligible patients. And even if you subtract the folks that are not eligible, even if you think that only about 60% of heart attack victims are eligible because they have conditions that would contraindicate one or the other of these treatments, because more than 750,000 Americans suffer heart attacks every year and get to the hospital in time to be treated, if you do all the math that's implied in those statements, the conclusion is more than 18,000 people die every year, preventable deaths, with heart attack, just because we don't do what we know works. This is not a problem of managed care. Quality is the problem, not managed care. So we have problems in overuse, we have problems in underuse. The Institute of Medicine report on errors highlighted the problems with misuse, with avoidable complications, and rightly so. These errors are incredibly frequent. Now, the one headline-catching number out of the Institute of Medicine report that perhaps as many as 100,000, 98,000 Americans may die in hospitals every year because of mistakes, is old news. The study that provided that number was published over 10 years ago. It actually came from work that was done examining care in New York State, so all of you out here are okay. That's not a problem here, I'm sure. And the other aspect of that study that was very interesting that I want to highlight for you because it leads to some other interesting implications is that in addition to looking at mistakes, this study looked at mistakes that were so serious that they could be qualified, they could be characterized as negligent. They were so egregiously beyond what any reasonable physician would do that they would be classified as negligence. And what they found in that study is that 1% of all patients admitted to hospitals were injured due to negligent mistakes. And lest you think these were minor occurrences, 25%, fully 25% of these negligent errors led directly to the patient's death. Now, that study, as I said, was published about 10 years ago. And what do you suppose the Medical Society's reaction in New York was when that study was published? The reaction was, this is terrific news. We're doing a great job. 99% of patients hospitalized were not injured due to negligence. I'm going to come back to that number. I want you to remember the 99% and the 18,000 preventable deaths from heart attack. There are many other examples. Medication errors is one of the most important causes of these injuries that occur during hospital stays. In fact, the literature shows the average large academic hospital in the average American city, in those institutions, about 2 patients per week are injured because of medication errors, totally preventable injuries. That's a quick series of highlights across the 3 major domains of quality problems and mistakes that we make in healthcare. And I think a fair summary is, of this literature, that mistakes that lead to harm are serious, they are widespread, you are not protected because you live in a city or you live in the country or you live in the West or you live in the East. This is not the result of managed care. Millions of Americans suffer the harm of these problems every day. So let's shift now to what's being done, what could be done. Well, the answer to what's being done is, I think, frankly, a little bit. In fact, there are a few stellar examples of improvement and of progress in these areas. But if you look across the wide expanse of our delivery system, keeping in mind the magnitude of the problems that we've just highlighted, these few examples of success are really isolated oases in a vast desert of failure. There are no examples of hospitals, medical practices, nursing homes, integrated delivery systems that have documented the sustained achievement of excellence across all dimensions of quality and in all aspects of the care they deliver. Why is that? I mean, isn't the American healthcare system the best in the world? Well, the answer is that it might be. We certainly have the capacity to deliver the best care in the world. The facts are, however, that we very often fail to deliver on that promise. One of the reasons is that the consuming public has not demanded better performance out of the healthcare system. They have demanded through purchasers lower premiums and lower cost, and they're getting that. They have not, by and large, demanded better performance on these kinds of clinical quality measures. On top of that, there is completely inadequate leadership from within healthcare. It's not coming from within the hospital industry, from within academic medicine, organized medicine. No segment of the industry has embraced all of these quality problems and said, these are ours. We are responsible. We are going to lead the way here. On top of that, there are tremendously conflicting payment incentives that differentiate healthcare from many other activities in society. If a large bank figures out how to reduce the mistakes they make in processing checks and streamline that process so they save money, that saving goes right to their bottom line. They have a tremendous financial incentive to make those improvements. That does not happen in healthcare very often. Too often, we get paid when we make mistakes. We get paid when we make mistakes, and we get paid to treat the complications of those mistakes very often. Tremendous payment conflict with quality incentives. And there's another problem, and it's really the flip side of a tremendous success story that's not well appreciated at all, and that is the recent and massive increase in the amount of knowledge we have about what works and what doesn't work. Those of us who are trying to deliver high-quality healthcare today face a qualitatively different ballgame than just 10 or 15 years ago. And I know you just built a wonderful new baseball park downtown for the Giants, not too far from here, and it occurred to me that what we face in healthcare is very much like what I imagine hitters in baseball would feel like if they came to the park one day and the pitchers all of a sudden had the ability to throw 200 miles an hour, twice as hard as the best pitchers today, meaning the hitters would have less than 2/10 of a second to react and hit that ball. It is simply beyond human capacity. So in healthcare, it is simply beyond human capacity today for an individual physician to keep in her or in his head all the information that they need to practice good medicine. And I thought of trying to find a way to quantify this because I like numbers. And the one that I've come up with that I think is a fair representation of this is looking at the number of articles in journals that we have to read to keep up with progress in healthcare, but the number of articles published from the best scientific research, from something called the randomized trial, the best design, the gold standard for what tells us what works and what doesn't. In the 1960s, 100 articles per year were published from randomized trials. By 1995, that number was 10,000 per year. And the most recent 5 years of that period saw more articles published from randomized trials than the previous 25 combined. Yet we continue to educate medical students, train young doctors, and expect physicians in practice to live by the old model of using your head to make perfect decisions every time. We've only begun to scratch the surface of thinking about what new ways we need to have to tabulate this information, to package it in ways that are digestible, and to get it to clinicians exactly when they need it to make good decisions. We have a lot to learn from other sectors of our society that have succeeded in reducing the rate of serious errors dramatically. Most of us, you know, were trained in an educational system where 85% was pretty good. 99%, there's that number again, A+. Well, would you be happy if 85% of your paychecks got deposited to your account? Would you be happy if 99% of the airplanes you boarded landed safely without killing anyone? So should we celebrate with the medical society when we learn that 99% of patients are not injured by negligence when they're hospitalized? Some companies have adopted a radically different way of thinking about quality and mistakes. They call it Six Sigma quality, and there's a lot of math behind that. Basically, what they do is to set expectations for excellence so high that they tolerate mistakes at a rate of less than 3 per million. 3 per million. Motorola invented this. It's since been expanded and made much more effective by Allied Signal, by General Electric. And some have actually achieved this goal in isolated parts of their business. There is one example in healthcare, and that is deaths due to anesthesia during surgery. They have been reduced to about 5 or 10 per million, about a 20-fold reduction in the last 20 years. The rest of healthcare performs at much, much lower levels. The 20% figure that I gave you for antibiotics wasted on colds translates in this Six Sigma frame of reference into 200,000 errors per million. The 99% figure of success translates into 10,000 errors per million. If the performance of some of the highest reliability industries that we have, whose standards of excellence that we take for granted, were suddenly to deteriorate to the level of many health services, some really astounding results would happen. At a defect rate of about 20%, the overuse number I gave you, antibiotics for colds, the credit card industry would make mistakes on 9 million transactions daily. Banks would deposit 36 million checks in the wrong accounts daily. Deaths from airplane crashes would increase 1,000-fold. The levels of failure that we experience in healthcare are simply intolerable. Let me give you a recent example from work that we're doing in New York with breast cancer treatment. We studied 4 hospitals, urban teaching hospitals, and we looked to see how many women with early-stage breast cancer, which is 95% curable if you do the right things in the right order, how many failed to get effective treatment. And we looked at the most critically important treatments that we know that evidence is excellent that improve disease-free survival. The best-performing hospital had a failure rate of 1 in 5. The worst performing hospitals, 1 in 3. We in healthcare need also to learn how other dangerous industries have improved so dramatically. Our reaction typically to mistakes and quality problems are to find who the nearest bystander was to the mistake and punish that individual, expecting that if we punish people, we can create more perfect humans. We exhort doctors and nurses to do better. But making people or trying to make people more perfect is not the way other industries like air travel have succeeded. They have succeeded by focusing on improving systems. Systems that understand that people make mistakes, but that anticipate those mistakes and either prevent them or compensate for them before they do harm. Doctors have a derogatory phrase for one tool that's been in use for 10 or 15 years to try to make practice more systematic, to make sure that steps are not eliminated. They're called clinical practice guidelines. Doctors sometimes call those guidelines cookbook medicine in a very derogatory way. Can you imagine a pilot objecting to cookbook flying because he has to use the same pre-flight safety checklist before every flight? The same checklist over and over again. Pilots know exactly where their planes are every second of that flight compared to the flight plan. They have to know that. Pilots aren't any more error-prone than doctors or nurses. They are supported by systems that anticipate the mistakes they make and compensate them for them before they do harm. Major reductions in mistakes can only happen by changing systems. One overall principle of systems that we are only starting to understand in healthcare is really quite simple and quite profound. And it's this. Every system is perfectly designed to produce the results that it gets. Say that again. Every system is perfectly designed to produce the results that it gets. So the system that we have of distributing antibiotics to people in the United States with infections is perfectly designed to waste one-fifth of all antibiotics on colds and viral infections. So the first corollary to that principle is, if you're happy with the results, don't worry about trying to change the system. The second corollary is where the rubber really meets the road. If you don't like the results, you can't change them unless you change the system that produces them. And you can't change the system that produces them by trying to make people behave perfectly. We have a very long way to go in healthcare before we even start to employ these lessons effectively. And let me just pause with a little parenthetical here. I don't mean to imply that system or process improvement is the only quality improvement activity that we need to undertake. It's sometimes portrayed as a choice between punishing really bad doctors, nurses, providers, hospitals, and encouraging everybody to improve. That is a false choice. We need to do both. Egregiously bad providers, whether they're doctors or nurses or physical therapists or hospitals, ought to be removed from the system if they can't improve. The point about system improvement is that we can't get the overall delivery system to improve unless we do this very hard job of changing processes and changing systems for everybody. That's the challenge. I believe that we should settle for nothing less than the transformation of healthcare into a high-reliability industry with results comparable to air travel. Remember the 18,000 preventable deaths from heart attacks I mentioned a little while ago. In the Northeast, we are still, 4 years later, talking about what happened to TWA Flight 800 that crashed off Long Island. We spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to figure that out. There was the Pierre Salinger missile theory, the exploding fuel tank theory. It took up pages and pages on all of our newspapers, headlines, talk shows, etc. The 18,000 preventable deaths from heart attack are equal to one TWA Flight 800 crash every 5 days. One disease. Now, what do I mean by results comparable to air travel for healthcare? I am not talking about perfect outcomes every time. That is simply not possible given our current state of medical knowledge. But I am talking about drastic reductions in the kinds of mistakes that we make every day that result in overuse, underuse, and misuse, with Six Sigma excellence as our goal. We should always provide effective care. We should always avoid ineffective services. And we should eliminate preventable complications. That is possible. You should demand it. We in the healthcare system should deliver it. Disease defeats us often enough. We shouldn't be defeating ourselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark Chasson, Chairman of the Department of Health Policy at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, for your remarks here today. Now Watson Letch, member of the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct our question and answer session.
Thank you, Dr. Mark Smith, President and CEO of the California Healthcare Foundation. Dr. Chasson, we have a large number of questions from the audience, so would you please come to the podium and let's begin. Recent statistics show that the U.S. is rather far down the list in terms of life expectancy of industrialized countries. Is this because we have a greater percentage of medical errors in our healthcare system than some of these other countries?
I think the answer to that clearly is no. There is no evidence that quality problems are any less in any other healthcare system in the world. In fact, the United States has pioneered in many, many ways the sciences of quality measurement and quality improvement. There are many more components to the life expectancy question than that. But clearly, one of the ways that we could close that gap is by doing a lot better job on quality improvement.
How many medical mistakes are the result of doctor incompetence versus those of a doctor's desire to pacify patients and conform to a general misguided perception on the patient's side of what works, i.e. patients believing that antibiotics combat colds and therefore demand them.
Now, the causation question is really a quite complicated one, and it's different for different kinds of problems. What we found, for example, in our work in breast cancer is that there was not a single instance in which the physician didn't know what the right thing to do was. And what most often happened is that an intended plan of treatment went awry, and there were no systems to get it back on track. And especially as our systems of providing care have gotten more and more complicated, the risk of error, of mistake, of an inadvertent result increases. So if you think about breast cancer, for example, it used to be that a woman with breast cancer went into the hospital, got an operation, and came out, and that was it. Now, the mammogram is done at one place, the biopsy is done at another place, the surgeon then decides with the family on what the right procedure is, that's usually done at another place, all outpatient, by the way. And then a referral has to get made to an oncologist for the question of whether additional chemotherapeutic treatment is necessary, to a radiation oncologist for the possibility of radiation. Each one of these steps and the complicated parts of the steps that are required for the woman to make the appointment, to show up, to get there, all increase the chance of error. And in fact, if any of you have had experience with this, the individual in this whole complicated system that is most often responsible for making sure that all the steps in the process are completed and that information about the previous step is brought along to the next one is who? It's the patient, remarkably. You're absolutely right. So what we've not figured out a way to do is build systems around these very complicated processes to find where patients and care goes off track and get it back on track. Doctor incompetence, to get to the other part of this question, is a very important problem, and I meant to highlight that in the brief remark that I made about this is not a choice between improving systems and finding really egregiously bad physicians or nurses or any other practitioner, and if they can't be remediated, to get them out of practice. We don't do either job very well, and we need to do both much better.
You've concentrated on the mistakes of physicians. Are the mistakes of nurse practitioners equal?
Everybody makes mistakes. Nurses, pharmacists, doctors, clerks, storekeepers, humans make mistakes. The mistakes that physicians make often have greater consequences for health than the mistakes that others make, but everyone makes mistakes. And we actually know a fair bit about the kinds of mistakes that people, humans, are more likely to make. We have imperfect memories, for example. So relying on physicians to remember everything that they need to practice good medicine is a bad strategy, not because physicians are bad, but because memory is fallible in all of us. So recognizing those particular kinds of fallibilities, the kinds of mistakes that people make, leads to the design of assist devices that prevent those mistakes from actually doing harm.
One member of the audience suggests that one sort of mistake might well be due to doctors' handwriting. Would you comment on that?
I should probably plead the Fifth Amendment. I'm a third-generation physician myself. My handwriting is awful. But the fact is that systems that rely on other individuals deciphering doctors' handwritings are asking for trouble. And that is a frequent source of error, particularly in the ordering of medications. Now, fortunately, and if you think about the complexity of these systems, what's really remarkable is that more patients are not injured by error. And the reason that more patients are not injured is that errors are intercepted and are corrected many, many times when they start going through the system. So if the clerk who's transcribing an order puts it on a nurse's cardex to be given to the patient, and the nurse sees that this is an order that doesn't make sense, she or he frequently takes it back to the physician and says, do you really mean this? And he says, no, of course I didn't mean that. And the error gets corrected. So handwriting is a big contributor, both on the inpatient side and on the outpatient side, where pharmacists have the challenge of interpreting handwriting.
Do doctors prescribe antibiotics for colds in order to avoid the risk of secondary infections? And this would be an area they would be liable.
I don't know of any real data that suggests that missing a secondary infection in this situation is a bona fide reason for fearing malpractice. I think that the reason that we have such a high rate of prescribing antibiotics for colds and other simple viral infections, and it's both in children as well as in adults, by the way, about half and half, is that physicians now have little time to sit with patients and explain why this is not a good thing to do. They are concerned about the amount of time they have to devote to individual visits. They feel pressured to deliver care in a very short period of time. It's much easier to write that prescription and move on than to spend the extra 15 or 20 minutes. It is a very important part of the problem that consumers, patients, believe that antibiotics are useful in this situation. And in fact, in a recent study that tried to have an impact on this problem, a study looked at educating consumers, educating clinicians, and putting educational materials in offices and tested which strategy was better. The only strategy that worked was the one in which they did all three in the same population. So in this instance, and I think in particular with respect to overuse problems, the public has to collaborate with the delivery system as part of the solution.
A couple of questions on practical matters. The herbal medical industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. Does this present some real public health problems? And along with that, is antibacterial soap a problem? Should it be left on the shelf and not purchased for home use?
Well, two very specific questions. There are clearly hazards from herbal medicine and from medications that are not subject to FDA approval and to the purity standards that medications that go through FDA approval have to have. They're dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, or maybe even thousands of documented episodes of serious allergic reactions to the other constituents of herbal preparations. And I think those medications, complementary alternative medicines, however you like to describe them, ought to be held to the same standards as medical interventions of scientific proof of efficacy. Antibacterial soap, I think, is still a question mark, but there's no question, none, that the single most important preventable cause of bacterial resistance is the incredible amount of antibiotics that we waste in circumstances where they don't benefit patients. If that 24 million Americans who receive antibiotics for these viral infections is right, that means, depending on how many pills they get, that upwards of half a billion doses are wasted every year and are let loose on the environment because we're not doing a good job in getting rid of this overuse problem.
Has there been a really serious effort to disaggregate the data on medical error? That is, can you categorize the different types and then focus on the ones that could be most easily prevented?
That's a really good question, and the answer is we have made some progress in this area, and the progress that's been made largely has been in the systematic analysis of medication errors in hospitals. And there what we see is that very often, if you look at the most serious harm that's done from errors, many different mistakes had to occur in the process before a patient experienced harm, that mistakes occur in the ordering process, in the transcription process, in the dispensing process, in the delivery process. And each one of those segments has many different underlying causes. And when you get down to the bottom of it, there are several repeating factors that keep coming up as the most important underlying explanations. For example, the most common underlying mistake is the wrong dose of a medication. That is a dose that fails to take account of adjustments that need to be made. Again, complexity, more knowledge, more fancy drugs, but these drugs have very important side effects, and they need to be modified for people that have compromised kidney function or liver function or people who are small as opposed to large. And failure to adjust doses for all of these things is one of the most common reasons that patients get too much of a drug and suffer harm as a result of it. A fix to that is to take that responsibility out of the hands of fallible humans and have a computer do it. And the best examples of success in reducing injuries due to medications have done just that.
You've commented on overdose of drugs. Most drugs for children are not specifically formulated for their use. Is this a serious problem?
Yes, medications for children are a serious problem, and it represents actually a conjunction of interesting issues among them. Children are very often not the subjects of experiments to determine which drugs work and which drugs don't for a variety of reasons, but it means that when a medication becomes available and is shown to work in an adult population, doctors have to scratch their heads and try to figure out whether this medication could be of use in children. It's not just a matter of reducing the dose to compensate for the size of the person. Children's metabolisms are different. Their risk of side effect is different because they're developing. And we need a much more concerted effort to figure out the ethically proper way to involve children in good scientific research so that our conclusions about what works and what doesn't are really much more directly applicable to children than they can be today.
Along with that question, are the incidence of errors equal for different age groups, children, middle-aged, elderly people, and what about gender?
Well, I guess the honest answer to that is that we really don't know because this is a very new area. The evidence that we have suggests that the people that are most likely to suffer from error are the most vulnerable. That is, people with chronic illness, people that are vulnerable because their organ function is compromised by age or comorbidity, so their margin, safety margin for tolerating a mistake is less. And that tends to be people who are older. I don't think there's much of an issue with respect to gender. It's probably relatively equal. Children are ordinarily pretty resilient, so they, even if a mistake is made with a drug that has a dose that's too high, they're probably less likely to suffer. But it's generally the most vulnerable patients that are subject to the harm of error.
Many of our urban areas in the country are multilingual to an amazing extent. Does the lack of qualified interpreters present a problem?
Yes. The lack of interpretation is a very important problem. In New York, I think in the public school system in New York State, there are 174 different languages spoken. That's actually a number that's been tabulated, so it means at least that many are spoken by patients that present to the healthcare system. It's a tremendous problem because taking a medical history is an enormous part of making the right diagnosis, and listening to complaints about problems following the initiation of treatment is one of the most important ways to figure out whether treatment's working, whether there was a mistake or not. So it's not only a problem in hospitals, it's a problem throughout the healthcare delivery system.
Does the AMA have any formal procedures or products in place to take into consideration the scale and nature of errors focused in the IOM studies?
Well, I think the AMA has done some things to make progress here. They have been involved in the National Patient Safety Foundation. Their individual state societies have taken some actions. But I think it's fair to say that overall, organized medicine, whether it's the AMA or medical specialty societies or academic medicine or any of the divisions of representing physicians, have not done nearly enough. What we need to have is medicine across the board in all of its constituencies, in my view, stand up and say, this is our problem. We are responsible for quality of care. We're not going to solve every problem by ourselves, but we are going to exert a leadership role to make healthcare safe. We need to do that in medicine, and we haven't done it with any amount of the degree of vigor that we should.
How can change occur in HMOs when the bottom line is the only criterion?
Well, the bottom line conflicts with quality all over the place, including in HMOs. You know, we have one way of paying for health care that encourages overuse, and that's the old way of paying by the piece for every service called fee-for-service. We have another great way of paying for health care that encourages underuse, and that's the way most HMOs get paid, a fixed payment per person. What nobody has invented yet is a way of paying for health care that rewards excellence. We do not have a way of paying for health care that harnesses the incredibly powerful motivating force of payment and puts it right in line with quality improvement. That does not exist anywhere. We've not spent enough time trying to figure that out. I think if we were able to figure it out, we'd find that a lot more investment would be made in quality improvement and a lot more progress would be made.
Are there any differences in the errors made by exhausted interns and residents versus more senior doctors?
Yes, more of them. Fatigue is an important catalyst for error that's been learned by most other dangerous high-reliability industries. That's why your airplane flights are delayed sometimes when a crew has to change because it's gone past its allotted time on duty, and you may be annoyed, but that's the idea behind that change in crew. We've not learned that in healthcare. We have decided that the old medieval apprenticeship in which the young acolytes gather around the master clinician and try to learn from him or her and then make perfect decisions every time, just like he or she does, that's the way to train physicians. And by the way, you also have to stay up all night every third night because that's the way I was trained. There is no information, no scientific data whatsoever that documents that that's a good way to train physicians, and we know that it's a good way to increase the risk of mistakes.
Earlier this week, Newt Gingrich proposed a system whereby every American's health record would be available online to doctors, and there would be legal protections for privacy purposes as a way to eliminate 30,000 deaths annually resulting from mistakes in prescriptions, medications, etc. And is this practical, likely to occur, and accurate on Gingrich's part? Could it be done cost-effectively? And as part of that, in terms of records, there are a whole host of startup companies now which propose to put patients' records online and permit the interaction of patients with medical staffs.
Well, I do think that there are a number of computer applications that could, in fact, reduce errors. There are errors that occur because one physician taking care of a patient does not have all the information that another physician taking care of the same patient has, and that frequently results, particularly in older Americans, in the collection of a group of medications that counteract each other, that interfere with each other, and that cause all sorts of debilitating drug interactions. So it is very important to coordinate care. I think that it remains to be seen whether the internet as a vehicle is safe enough, is secure enough, is confidential enough to make that happen. There certainly are individual applications that are starting to show some promise. But what we need to focus on, I think, is the changing of the system, not the vehicle by which the system is changed, but an analysis of where the mistakes are occurring, and then designing a lot of different ways to fix those systems. Computers, internet may be part of the solution. It's a promising new vehicle. It still remains to be seen whether it can really be harnessed to improve healthcare.
To follow on with that question, we have quite a number on the role of technology. What role do you see technology playing across the board in preventing medical errors?
Well, I think technology has two faces, sort of a Jekyll and Hyde kind of posture. Technology, and I'm thinking very broadly of all the new stuff that we invent every year, from the standpoint of delivering care and delivering effective care, has enormous benefit. It's really the source of a lot of the progress that we've made in treating all sorts of disease. The Mr. Hyde part of that equation, however, is that while we are terrific at inventing this stuff, best in the world, we are awful at evaluating it, at figuring out exactly when it works to improve health and when it doesn't, and then we're even worse at limiting its use to those proven effective circumstances. So we let all of these new technologies out of the barn without much in the way of evaluation. Even in the case of medications and the FDA, once the FDA says this is safe and effective, doctors can use it for any purpose that they like, whether there's evidence of its effectiveness or not. And if we don't get a handle on that, we will never get too far down the road of correcting overuse. Now, on the other side of the equation, technology can be incredibly helpful in avoiding mistakes because some technological applications are perfectly suited to be the counterpoint for human fallibility. We talked about memory. The other aspect of human fallibility in this regard is calculations. We don't do calculations very well. It's not the fault of our fourth grade math teachers. We can't do calculations as well as computers can do them. So if you have to do a complicated calculation for a medication dose to be correct, let's let the computer do it and let's get it right every time.
We have several questions on life support systems and managed suicide. How can I avoid being put on life support against my will when ambulance drivers do this on the way to the hospital and getting off is considered murder? And the other is, how would a national bill on allowing assisted suicide change health care in this country?
Well, that's pretty far removed from errors, but I actually have an opinion about this because as health commissioner, we wrote a very important book on this subject that became part of the record in the Supreme Court case that was very influential in this area. Assisted suicide, I think, is an incredibly complicated set of issues. I am personally opposed to legislating assisted suicide because I worry, having had responsibility for looking over quality from the standpoint of a community of 18 million folks in New York, I worry about the abuses that assisted suicide could engender. Right now, in every state in the country, and I think there may be only two exceptions, California not being one of them, there are legal protections that you can invoke, whether it is in the form of a healthcare proxy, that is, a designated individual who you give permission to make decisions for you in healthcare if you become unable to do that yourself, or a durable power of attorney. There are different names for it. The key is, number one, to access that vehicle and make sure that you carry it out in a way that is enforceable in your state, but that is not sufficient. You have to make sure that that information is with every physician that provides your care, every close relative who's going to get contacted when you become ill, so that they can intervene. These are pieces of paper. We have no system of keeping track of who has signed one of these, who hasn't, who's changed their mind, for whom it's still in force. So unfortunately, it is now up to the individual to make sure that these arrangements are clear to everybody in the family and clear to all of the caregivers who are providing care to you. In that situation, they work fairly well. In many situations, however, when an individual does this, the family's not aware. One doctor may be aware, but another doctor may not be. The nursing home may not be aware. And then miscommunication develops. It's only when everybody's on the same page and repeatedly informed about these arrangements that they do work very well.
What do you think about a mandatory public reporting system for errors in healthcare?
Well, a mandatory reporting system could work, and it could work if it were done in a way that information was collected on serious errors, reported to a central agency that could analyze those data and look for patterns of how they occurred, why they occurred, and then report back to the hospitals or the nursing homes or whoever it was that submitted the information on the errors in the first place so they could learn from that information and improve. And I think that that could work. Unfortunately, we have no examples of where that actually happens today. We have some examples in other industries. The airline industry, which is a useful model in many respects, has two different kinds of reporting systems. One is the reporting system on accidents, in which an investigation occurs after every single one. It's very public. All the reports are public and made available. The other is a voluntary and anonymous reporting system where pilots can call when they see a mistake that gets made that may not result in harm, but those near misses, those close calls, are just as informative as accidents in looking for where the process still needs to be fixed to make it even safer. The airline safety reporting system has worked incredibly well in that regard as a voluntary, non-punitive, anonymous reporting system that also does the same thing, analyzes those patterns, reports back to the industry for ways to improve. We could, in healthcare, make use of both of those strategies. We've got a long way to go before we have workable models in healthcare.
In our fragmented medical system in this country, how will we get started? Where does the push come in terms of reducing the number of errors on a national basis?
That's a really good question. And I think the answer is that it has to start with every one of us. Every one of us. Whether we are connected with the healthcare system or not. If we are not connected with the healthcare system, we need to start demanding better performance. One of the reasons that we spend hundreds of millions of dollars investigating air crashes is that we as flyers, as passengers on those planes, expect the level of performance to be nearly perfect, Six Sigma quality. We don't expect that in healthcare. And if we don't demand it, the chances of our getting it are much, much reduced. If we are connected with the healthcare system, we need to get way past all the excuses that we put on the table year after year for not taking effective action. It's too hard, it's too expensive, I'm worried about malpractice or this or that, we don't know how to measure quality, can't define it. Throw all that stuff away. It is all bogus. We know how to measure quality. We know how to define it. We can do quality improvement inside institutions, particularly hospitals in every state in the country, without worrying about malpractice. There is no excuse any longer for not getting started in a major way.
We have time for one last question. We all know about Hillary Clinton's interest in healthcare. Will this be a factor in the race in New York? And what advice do you intend to give her?
So far, healthcare in the Senate race has not really shown itself as a major issue. I don't know whether it will in the future. I think that we have a lot of both local and national issues in New York that are affecting the Senate race. So far, healthcare is not among them, and I'll keep the advice that I'm going to give Mrs. Clinton to myself.
Our thanks to Dr. Mark Chasson, Chairman of the Department of Health Policy at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, for joining us today. We also thank our audience here at the St. Francis Hotel, as well as those listening on radio, and we invite you to visit us again soon. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the California Healthcare Foundation is adjourned.